Well, my guest today grew up in the Troubles around Northern Ireland in the 80s and 90s, very, very similar to myself. But that's pretty much where our lives went off in completely different tangents, because I went off to England to play professional football. My guest today became a chartered accountant for PwC and then went on to be the group MD of a company that reached almost £100 million turnover. That is an amazing conversation. This guy has so many nuggets and pearls of wisdom that I think you're going to really enjoy. So let's get into this. Hi everyone, and welcome back, or welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Paul McVeigh. And if you're joining us for the first time, I'm a performance psychologist and keynote speaker. And I'm on a mission to understand the world of elite performance. Now, I've been really fortunate in the first few episodes to learn from the likes of international rugby, the Olympics, NFL, sports psychology, football. But today we're going to delve into the world of business. And my guest today has been the MD of CDE Global and helped that company grow to almost $100 million turnover. He is also the co-founder of Simple Scaling. So please welcome Brendan McGuigan. Brendan, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Paul. Thank you for that very generous intro, and humbled and delighted to be on the show.
No, absolute pleasure. And listen, I'm delighted just to have someone that has the same accent as me. So let's give everybody around the world listening a real challenge and just trying to understand our accents.
We'll be on our best behavior.
We'll do. We'll see what we can do. But listen, I'm going to kick off the show the way I do with every single one of my guests. And I want to ask you, what is the definition of success?
Oh, great question. For me, it's about getting up every day and contributing positively to a worthy goal. It's in doing that, it's maintaining strong relationships, solid relationships, good friendships, and maintaining my own well-being and achieving those goals. And really, for me, definition of success, wrapping all of that up, is about creating, doing something positive.
Well, I think that's a really, really good start, because, you know, it's interesting. I've had a few different sportsmen on the show. I've had people who've worked in the world of sports psychology. And, you know, I'm really, really delighted that you accepted our invitation and you wanted to come on the show, because, you know, your career, your background is completely different to everybody I've interviewed and spoken to so far. So, of course, you started off as an accountant. You grew up in that world of business, the whole university, going into, you know, one of the big four. So can you tell me, because when I jump forward to your introduction of helping a company grow to almost 100 million turnover, that's such a massive gap between you qualifying as an accountant to suddenly becoming in that position in the last few years. So can you tell me how that kind of started off and what you initially wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, it's a great question. Just to put that in context, I took my first plane ride at 19, and in the end up we developed our business across six continents. So there was a few more plane rides between I was 19 and I'll be 46 next week. So in terms of getting to that point, look, I grew up probably similar to yourself, Paul. Dad went out to work. He was a bookkeeper in a car dealership. Mum stayed at home. There was five of us. I was the middle of five, which my siblings tell me keeps me very well balanced with a chip on both shoulder. So I grew up having to kind of fight my way in the house. And there was a great, I mean, you'll recall, you're younger than me, but certainly when I was growing up, there was a huge emphasis put on education. And my mum used to say, look, son, I've nothing to give you. I'll make sure you're well fed, and we'll aim to give you a good education. And says, there's two ways I feel you can make it in life. One's with the spade and the other's with the pen. And I reckon, you know, you're more inclined to do it with the pen. So, but there was always a great work ethic in the house. I mean, there was no such thing as waking up in the morning, getting on the FIFA. I remember 8 or 9 years of age, we on the bikes and headed out, and you picked strawberries until you were 10. At 10, then you graduated into the orchards, and you pulled water shots. You, as you get a little bit older, you start pulling apples, and then you know, so I had always jobs. There's a great work ethic. And I have to say, my older brother was a great inspiration as well. He worked very hard. He's the coroner in Northern Ireland now. He had his own legal practice. And so I had a great role model from a learning perspective. And I always had a great appetite to learn. So my dad, as I said, was a bookkeeper. He used to come home in the evenings and he had these huge big green ledgers. And I was fascinated. It was this ritual that would happen at the end of tea time. The table would be cleared down. And I was the only one that took an interest in what Dad was doing with these big green ledgers. And I would sit at the end of the table and watch him kind of methodically going through all of the entries from the day's kind of takings from the sale of the cars. I graduated to him letting me use the calculator. And I remember him always saying, "And I think you'll be a chartered accountant someday, son." And I had no idea what a chartered accountant was. I just enjoyed helping him. And it's interesting because, you know, from an environmental perspective, I did become a chartered accountant, not knowing what it was. I went straight in, you know, went to university, finished my degree at 21, and straight into the big four, as you mentioned. It was Coopers and Lybrand then, which is PricewaterhouseCoopers now. But I really wanted to get into, for me, accountancy was a passport into industry. I didn't want to stay in practice as such, but I thought this was a great way to get into industry. I'd worked in a whole host of jobs from I was kind of 8, as I said, until I was 20, put myself through university, and loved business. So that gave me the passport, you know, qualifying as chartered accountant gave me a passport in the industry. And I was very fortunate after a couple of years of getting my exams, and still a year and a half of my contract to run, and I got seconded into business as an interim financial controller in different businesses. One was MDS Harris in Lisburn Road. And I remember that quite vividly, because after 6 days there, I got having owned my first new car, I got it stolen after 6 days on the Lisburn Road. So I remember that role. And then from there, they offered me a role, but I was still in contract. And whenever I came out of contract, I was then, this was kind of early 2000s during the dot-com boom. And I got offered a role in a tech company to join the leadership team there. So, you know, that was right in the kind of the heart of the tech boom, and then the infamous tech bust. So, I had a great grounding right up until until I was 28 before I joined CDE.
Well, that's what I want to know about, because whenever I'm talking about, you know, the sportsmen or people who, you know, started off, and, you know, for instance, last time we had Shaka Hislop, who was growing up in Trinidad and Tobago, watching the FA Cup, you know, on TV through the years, and then finally played in the FA Cup final because it was always something he'd wanted to do. But you're talking about you were the one who sort of was fascinated by what your dad was doing. And then it kind of, I suppose, poses the question of that nature nurture. Was it because your dad was doing it and that's why you did it? But then, of course, there are five of you, and I'm guessing none of the others had the same career path that you've had.
Yeah, they've all done really well. You know, so there's something there, and I think you'll recall back, you know, growing up in Northern Ireland, you know, during the 80s, quite a challenging time. We lived, you know, in Portadown. It was cited as the murder triangle at the time we were growing up. My mum was from the country. She really wanted to get back to the country. My dad was from the town. And we did eventually get back to the country. But I think that certainly from an environmental perspective, you were very aware, without it being explicit, that there's something happening here, and the way that you can kind of get yourself out of this is to get educated. And there was huge emphasis on that. Without, my mum didn't, you know, neither my mum or dad went to school at a higher level, so they didn't fully understand kind of the importance of getting a degree. But it was conveyed to us the importance of actually getting an education. And so from that perspective, then, and I gravitated to where I enjoyed maths, enjoyed the kind of the numbers side of things going through school. So it just seemed natural. And then the accountancy qualification, I went to a Christian Brothers school. The accountancy A-level was offered in the girls' secondary school. So we got to go over there. So maybe there was something in that in terms of the attraction to do accountancy. But anyway, and then I naturally gravitated into doing the degree. So yeah, nature or nurture, I think certainly my parents had a huge role to play and directed and guided me. You know, it seemed natural just to gravitate towards accountancy at that stage. But in the back of my head, for me, it was an insurance policy and a passport to business and in many respects, travel. For me, I thought this qualification travels right across the globe. And so from that perspective, it seemed, it just seemed a natural thing to do.
But you're calling it natural. I'm not sure if I was, 16, 17, 18, if I would have been thinking like that, if I'd have gone down the university route. And I don't think I've ever really told anyone this before. If I wasn't going to be a footballer, I think I would have been an accountant because I just had a real fascination with numbers. But I never saw it as something that this could take me all around the world. But it sounds like your mindset and your psychology was, I know if I can get this almost tool on my tool belt, then this opens up the whole entire business world to me.
Yeah. Where did that come from? I'm not sure, Paul, but really it struck me, I suppose, there was almost a sense that mum had to stay at home to look after the five of us. Dad had to go to work and they wanted more for us. They encouraged us to, growing up in Portadown, it would have been easy for them to have kind of narrow views on certain things. They didn't. They always encouraged us to travel. So, for example, was it 18 or 19? At 19, I went to America, worked in America for 3 months, actually laboring, and wasn't going to go home actually until the guy that I was laboring for, who was an Irish guy, said, I'm not going to go home and finish my final year of a degree. And he says, well, I'd earned that much money during the 3 months. And again, that gave me a real thirst for that level of independence, travel. I had a wonderful summer, the 3 months there in the States. And he said, well, no, you are going home because I'm not giving you a job. But he said, finish your degree. And if you want to come back out here, then I'll have a job for you. But I guarantee you, we'll never see each other again. That was quite profound. The following year, then I travelled around Europe. I couldn't afford the Interrail, but we went on Eurobus. So I travelled around Europe for 6 weeks on a bus with traveller's checks. You'll not remember these. And before the Euro, so we were travelling between it was francs and lira, and you had to change all of the currencies, and there was days where you would travel through a number of countries and wouldn't eat that day because if you change at the stopover your currency to buy the food, then you weren't staying in that same country the night. So you were trying to be strategic in terms of how you use the traveler's checks. My wife still berates me in the fact that I did such a good job in budgeting for that 6 weeks that I was able to come home and tax the car. But 400 quid to go around Europe for 6 weeks.
Typical accountant, always thinking about the pennies in there.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Brendan, you're talking about almost like the base of what allowed you to go on and have such a remarkable career that you've had, and we're definitely going to get into that later. You also just touched on the fact of, growing up like I did in Belfast, you were in Portadown, in the Troubles, in the kind of 80s and 90s. Without going into too much of that, can you maybe just give people who are listening who've maybe heard of this before, because there'll be people tuning in from all around the world, with the people who are connected with us on our social media, Can you give it almost like a very short indication of just what that was like for you?
Yeah, again, my parents did a fantastic job of insulating us. But in the background, you knew there was a lot of conversations about getting out of the town. As I mentioned earlier, Portadown was considered the murder triangle, you know, growing up in the 80s. As a kind of a young Irish Catholic in the town, that brought about its own challenges. You know, there were always news reports of beatings, you know, unfortunately, some tragic deaths as I was growing up. And so there was just this air, you know, a sense that this isn't the most positive environment that we can be growing up in, and a sense that, again, to get educated, you could move beyond this. In many respects, you know, the parents were almost settled that this was their life, but they wanted much more for the five of us, and hence the emphasis on education at the time. But yeah, look, you know, I grew up in that. It was constantly, you know, it was checkpoints whenever you're out in the car with your parents. There was a heavy police presence, a heavy army presence. You know, I recall as a kid coming home from school, we used to walk from the where the bus depot was in the centre of town home, and I remember actually different days getting getting in the back of the police Land Rover because some kids had started to stone us at the top of the railway bridge, and this went on for a number of weeks. And I mean, I was in primary school at this stage, so you know, to be in the back of one of those, you recall the grey Land Rovers at that stage, it was, you know, there was a sense that this just wasn't right. And there was another, you know, there was another opportunity for us, there's another alternative. And that, you know, my mom, as I say, was always quite keen to get us out of the country. But yeah, so, I mean, you recall, there was a heavy presence of police, army. You remember growing up, even televised interviews, if Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness was being interviewed, their faces were blacked out, their voices were dubbed. You know, it was something on the news all of the time about the Troubles. And that was just, you know, that's the way we grew up.
And it's interesting whenever you're talking about it and listen to your experience, and essentially you were probably about 30, 40 miles away from me when I was growing up. And whenever I try and explain this to people of what it was like growing up with, you know, bombs going off on a daily basis and tanks driving down past your street and etc., I suppose the only way I can describe it to people is sum it up in one word. And that's normal. It was just normal for that to happen. And it was only whenever I left England, or left for England at 16 in the mid 90s, that I suddenly was walking down through a street in North London and this wasn't happening, and soldiers weren't walking past you with their guns and their rifles. And I was like, okay, so this isn't normal. It is only what happens around where I grew up. But I was interested to hear what your take on was that, because a lot of times that can be the driving factor for what people do and go on to do and the success you have had. So let's jump forward to, you're suddenly at CDE, you've been given this opportunity. Now, you didn't start off as MD and to go on to have the success and build the business the way you helped and were integral for. How did you make that transition initially into CDE and then to go on to be MD?
Yeah, so, well, great deal of luck. It didn't seem like luck at the time, but I mean, I mentioned I was in part of a leadership team during the infamous tech bubble. So it was my first role in industry. What was part of the finance team leading the growth of a tech company in Belfast, and we'd kind of set up offices in America, in Hong Kong, in the UK, you know, bringing people on at a rapid rate. And I mean, that was such a wonderful insight into business. I had the great fortune to work with some amazing people, some amazing leaders within that business. And I remember being, I suppose, leading the redundancies as that whole tech sector and that bubble started to unravel. And it was maybe the third round of redundancies. And I mean, I was in my mid-20s, had formed great friendships with the software engineers, again, young guys my age. We had played football on a Tuesday evening, and there I was sitting across the desk on a Thursday looking at a spreadsheet and their name was on it. And I thought, I'm not a software engineer. I don't necessarily need to be in this industry. And at that stage, I had a call from a lady recruiter who we used for Amicus at the time. And she said, look, I've got this opportunity. It's in Mid Ulster, and I'd love you to go and have a chat with the founder of the business. So I thought, you know what, actually, there's nothing to lose by having a conversation. And I did a little bit of due diligence on the company, made a couple of calls, and then I went and had a meeting with the founder at that stage. And we had a couple of meetings, and he, a wonderful sales guy, and convinced me to come on board. At that stage, we had revenues of about £3 million, team of about 15 people, and I suppose huge ambition. 85% of those revenues were coming from Ireland. So I joined as finance director, along, and the kind of was the founder and one other shareholder, a guy my age, who great friend of mine, and I became MD then a number of years later, and was group MD for about 12 years. So 2007, I became the MD just before the global financial crisis. So I had, I've been asked by the founder and the other co-shareholder to actually take the MD role. I was really proud to do that, quite overwhelmed, and but within 6 months then the global financial crisis hit, and so navigated through that for the next 12 years until then 2019 I founded Simple Scaling.
But that is such a huge journey, Brian. You talked about, you know, go from 3 million turnover and the majority of your business is coming in Ireland. You ended up, was it with offices in over 100 countries, pretty much on every continent on the planet? Now, because that's such a massive jump, I'd love to hear about, you know, some of the challenges that you overcame, or maybe even some of the turning points that allowed you to catapult forward.
Yeah, so we exported to more than 100 countries globally. We'd set up offices in 6 continents and achieved between 2008, 2009, kind of the revenues nosedived. We reported a loss that year. And then the global financial crisis really was the catalyst for a lot of change within the business. It forced us to innovate in the product. It forced us to innovate in the process. And I was very fortunate. I mean, I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm not an engineer. So whenever I came to the role initially, it was a case of what do I bring to this? And I suppose the discipline and the training on the finance side had given me, a great grounding in actually getting clarity on the future. And I was always, I think, growing up, mum and dad always encouraged us to kind of see the future, look beyond where we are now, look beyond what do you want for your life. So that was just ingrained with us. So that's what I brought to the role initially. It was a case of where do we take this company? What's the vision? What we needed clarity and where we wanted to take it. So within a number of weeks of taking the role initially, I brought the other two shareholders into a little library room in one of the local country hotels, and we spent an afternoon then in crafting. I wanted to know from the other two guys, if I was going to be Group MD, where were we taking this company to? Were we all aligned on growth, and how were we going to grow the company so that we, I had a perception of what I wanted, but was that aligned with the other two guys? And as I say, within 6 months, the global financial crisis hit, so that vision was tore up, and it was just about survival. But that's that desire to survive galvanized us. It really, really solidified the team. Again, small team, probably at that stage, about 50 to 60 people. And everybody, and again, it's the importance of culture. I was really transparent, kind of, and I'm a big believer that transparency creates trust. So when things were good, you report that it's good. When things are not so good, you know, again, you report that it's not so good. You don't sugarcoat it in that. And from that perspective, you build a lot of trust with people. So, you know, what I conveyed to the team at that stage was my job was as much under threat as anyone else's. So, look, my sense of that was let's roll our sleeves up here and really do our damnedest to navigate through this. It was very challenging or very difficult to forecast how long it would last. In fact, we won our last significant project in 2008. It was a project just over €2 million and never won another project of that scale for about 5-6 years later, because all of the big companies, the PLCs, they closed their purse strings. There was a CapEx freeze across the industry. And we had to innovate then and move from what was a project-based business to a product business, innovate in products, standardize to some degree the product, but then also innovate in the processes. So there was a great sense of, look, we galvanized behind that cause. It was a burning platform, really, of just survival. And it's amazing what that did for the company in terms of actually getting that level of discretionary effort from a team that would just was amazing. And we navigated through that, and over the next 12 years achieved almost £500 million worth of revenue cumulatively, you know, significant profitable growth and positive from a cash perspective, which will allow us to invest in a new headquarters back in 2016, 2017, and a new manufacturing facilities as well. So, yeah, there was lots of things in there, Paul, that were certainly pivotal.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that as with all investing, your capital is at risk. Now, Brendan, that seems like very similar to the story of what the world's going through today in the pandemic. So kind of leaving the CD for a second, because I do want to come back in, because there's so much there about performance, about leadership and teamwork and culture that I would love to delve into. But jumping ahead now, you're the co-founder of Simple Scaling, and all of that experience and knowledge and expertise that you've taken from your extensive career so far, you're now helping SMEs to allow them to build and scale. And that must be really rewarding for the work you're doing now.
Yeah, it really is, Paul. And I didn't appreciate what we had done with, and certainly the experience that I had within CDAs, having spent 17 years there. And we won a host of awards, Deloitte Best Managed Company for 12 years running. We're one of 1,000 companies acknowledged by the London Stock Exchange to inspire Europe. We were part of the Sunday Times Fast Track 100, both in the revenue side and profit growth. And I just thought, you see, you're cocooned in a bubble. This was my entire life. In fact, my wife was pregnant with my eldest daughter whenever I joined CDA, and she'll be 18 now in September. So, you know, the kids knew nothing else, and I was cocooned in this bubble. What I realized then, or came to realize, I suppose in the latter years, is what we were doing was not the norm, and it was quite exceptional. And just to put that in context, only 2% of SMEs globally ever achieve scaling. What that is kind of 3 years annualized growth of 20% or more, with starting that period with at least 10 employees. So this word scaling only came into my lexicon really in 2015. Prior to that, I wouldn't have been aware of it. It kind of only was born then. And so what we were doing was scaling. And I had received approaches from other business owners, other business leaders who wanted to grow their businesses as well, wanted to understand what we had done in there. And I started to reflect then So after retiring, that lasted a weekend. I reflected on what it was that we had done and defined then, along with my co-founder of Simple Scaling, Claire, we defined 10 principles of scale-up. And I've spent the last almost 18 months researching and interviewing scores of people across the globe to reaffirm those 10 principles of scale-up. And one of the research reports actually cited that it was a research report commissioned by the Scale-Up Institute back in 2015. They said if we increased the number of scale-up SMEs by 1%, it would create by 2034 150,000 net new jobs, and over that period to 2034 potentially contribute between 70 and 225 billion to the UK economy alone, just 1%. So, and again, in 2018, to get a sense of this, 2018, there were 5.7 million SMEs who contributed £2 trillion worth of revenue into the UK economy. 34,000 of those contributed half of it, £1 trillion. So we're inspired, and certainly my purpose now, to inspire and enable ambitious leaders of SMEs to scale with purpose. If you can move the needle just a tiny 0.00%, then the ramifications, the positive impact of that will be significant. So that I've arrived at my purpose now in terms of supporting the SMEs to scale.
And it sounds so inspiring. I can just hear the enthusiasm and the passion that's in your voice when you're talking about that. And even though there's so many statistics in there, but the numbers and the vast numbers that you're quoting there, you know, this is just so huge. And whenever I think about, you have done what probably over those 5 million SMEs around the country, they, I'm guessing, aspire to do. So you must be like that kind of unicorn that, you know, very, very, very few companies ever do. And you're someone who has that knowledge and you're now sharing that. So can you maybe give me, I don't know, I don't want to give me all 10 of your principles, because that's obviously your business, your IP, but maybe one or two that is really crucial for SMEs to give them any chance of this scaling you're talking about?
Yeah, well, interestingly, the very first principle, and there, you know, the principles are all shared on our website, simplescaling.com, so I invite anyone to go over there and have a look at the 10 principles. The very first principle is psyche. The mindset of the owner or founder or leader of the business, because again, a report commissioned in 2015 carried out by Oxford and Cambridge universities who were investigating why there's so very few SMEs achieve scale, concluded that lack of ambition by the founder is one of the key determinants as to, or impediments as to, why companies don't scale. And I don't agree that it's a lack of ambition, because the very fact that these people have created their own businesses in the first instance suggests that they're hugely ambitious. But I think they arrive at a place where they struggle to know what are the next steps. So psyche is the very first principle. The mind, the other 9 principles almost are futile to start there unless you can eyeball the founder or leader or CEO of the business and be convinced that they want to scale the business, because it's challenging. There's no question. I mean, that's why so very few do it. It's challenging. But if you can actually instill that belief by communicating and giving them a roadmap, a pathway to scale, then we're moving. You know, the next principle then is purpose and vision. So having a cause, understanding why you want to scale this business. And it has to move beyond profits. Take profits as a given. But moving beyond the desire to make more money, why do you exist? And then the vision aspect of that, where do you want to go with it? You know, because you'll only ever grow within the framework of your own ambition. So what is your ambition level? And then we get on to people. Once you have that understanding of your purpose and your vision, and the mindset solid, and you have a desire to want to grow, then it's about actually, you know, galvanizing a team of people behind the purpose, behind the cause, and giving them the direction and the sense of the vision. And then we move on to, you know, the planning aspects, the process, they all begin with P. You get on to the planning, the process, performance, and then we move to proposition, partnerships, and the actual positive growth culture in itself. So without taking too much time on all of the principles, that's a very quick overview, Paul.
But again, Bryn, that's the kind of knowledge and expertise that I think anyone listening to this, especially if anyone, you know, who owns or runs a company or is leading a company or even leading a team in a senior position, this is the kind of knowledge and almost esoteric knowledge that most people don't have. And not that I've ever built a business to what you're talking about in terms of the scale and that you had, but I always heard and understood that the expertise and knowledge that takes a business to 0 to 1 million is going to have to be different from that 1 million to 10 million, which is going to be different again from the 10 million to 100 million. And this is all of the stuff you're talking about. So really, I think it goes back to the very first thing you're talking about in terms of the psyche. You'd call it psychology, I'd call it psychology, you call it psyche, but really it's your mindset, your mentality, ultimately thinking is what's going on in that individual's head. And that's why it's so fascinating to me, because I have the exact same opinion, you know, philosophy when it comes to helping people understand what the world of football is like. Because you could be the best player in the world, the greatest athlete, but if the psychology isn't right, you can almost forget about everything else.
Completely agree. And I wish I'd learned this in school, to understand that your conscious thoughts, what you allow in, and it's back to that, you know, the quote by Jim Rohn, stand guard at the door of your own mind, understanding that you can, your five sensory factors, your sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, they're receivers, they're antennae, they're taking stuff in all of the time. Now, if you don't have clarity on a vision, then you will accept any stuff in. So, I was cycling yesterday, stopped in for a cup of coffee with a friend of mine, and we looked at the newspaper rack and the newsstand as you're walking in the left hand side. I deliberately tune off the news. Whatever news I need to get, I will hear it. There's no question. If it's significant, I will hear it. And I don't mean that in a negligent way and kind of create this little bubble around me, but understanding that, you know, understanding what it is I can control, and it's about controlling the controllables. So having clarity in what you want, where you want to go, and then being deliberately conscious about what you allow in, you know, and that's what you read, who's in your network, what you're listening to. You've been deliberately intentional in that regard. So taking in only that information which is going to serve your vision on a conscious level, which then influences your subconscious. And our subconscious, it dictates 95% of what we do. As you know much better than me from a psychology perspective, but 95% at the time, we're just on autopilot. So if you don't make a conscious effort to influence the subconscious, which determines how we feel, which in turn then determines how we act, and ultimately our results are simply a manifestation of how we think. There's a wonderful book by James Allen, actually it was written back in 1903, As a Man Thinketh, and essentially, you know, he talks about the environment as just is simply a looking glass of your thoughts. So your thoughts are the cause, the results are the effect. And when you know that, then you become really deliberately intentional and conscious about what you then start to take in. So that's the psyche of the founder. It's why we spend on the program, we've 12 C's going through the ScaleX Accelerator program at the moment. We spend a lot of time on their vision. And it's incredible. People will spend more time choosing a car than they will determining the outlook for their business. You know, so it's fascinating.
Well, that's a great analogy, Bryn. That's a great analogy. You talk about, you know, more time choosing a car than for their business. And I would even almost take a step back again for a bigger picture, because the car you drive and the business that you work in or that you've founded is also only one part of your life. So when you're talking about purpose, and that really seems to keep jumping out at me all the way through, you know, our conversation today, that it's about purpose in your life. And it's not just about your business life, it's about your entire life. And, you know, without being judgmental in any way, shape or form, because, you know, I'm in no position to be judging others, but more of an observation that I do find a lot of people don't have that real clarity in their purpose in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, again, like you, I can't judge, but I know the amount of work that I have spent, you know, on a daily basis. I have a ritual of journaling to understand what is it that drives me. And certainly in recent years, I've taken the time to reflect what it is that drives me. Whenever I looked at my life, both from a professional perspective and then outside of work, I've always been driven by personal growth and business growth. That's what I've been attracted to, which is then no accident why I've arrived at a point of co-founding Simple Scaling. And I completely agree. Having a cause to understand why you do what you do and not just kind of drift along, but actually stop and reflect and say, is this really what I want to be doing? Is this the best use of the gifts that I have? Am I creating? I mean, imagination is the one higher mental faculty that distinguishes us amongst all other mammals. We, our ability to imagine and create. So, you know, are we using those creative faculties to serve others? And is it something that we want to be doing? And if it's not, then why are we doing it? So it's always seeking that alignment. And you know when you're doing something that you love, because you come back to talking, you know, again, better than me, that state of flow where you just time passes. You're in that state of enjoyment. You're in a state of creativity. And I think purpose is something that people have become much more conscious about over the last 12 months. COVID has really heightened people's awareness, and especially maybe I'm in my mid-40s, just a reflection on what's it all about, and am I using the unique gifts that I have to serve others in the best possible way? So it's no accident that purpose, you see it come more and more and more to the fore as people now reflect that we're all living on this one planet. We have to be conscious about how we treat that planet. We have to be conscious about how we treat the people on this planet. And then the profit element will take care of itself.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Brendan, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions, because one is about how a lot of people, I feel and think, they get up in the morning just because they need to go and pay the bills, and they just want to, you know, feed their family, and they just want to do the job, and that's fine. But I suppose whenever people who have maybe, whether they've been successful in a sporting career, whether they've been successful in their own business or whatever they have done, whenever the kind of the money and the finances are taken care of and almost that isn't a worry for them anymore, do you think it's then that they maybe don't have that purpose, or the purpose then drives everything they do?
The latter, absolutely. I think for a lot of people, and a lot of people should, well, we should all should ask ourselves the question, if you did not have any financial worries, would you be currently doing what you're doing? And if the answer is no, then you've got to question why it is that you're doing it. Because where I've arrived at, I mean, we've won life, and You must certainly encourage people to channel that their energies and their creativity and their unique ability to what it is that they want to do. I always get quite saddened when I hear people, you know, in their mid-40s, maybe late 40s, and they're looking forward to retirement. This notion that you're going to live your life whenever you retire, that to me is, you know, is a crazy notion. It's why not now take the time to reflect on what it is that you want from your life, and then start taking little actions, still little habits towards the life that you actually want to be living. So, yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, of course, Brendan, it absolutely does. It really resonates with me. And you know, I think I probably have obviously had a different life experience and almost lived my career the opposite way around, where from I got quite a lot of, you know, success at the start of my working life and then kind of gradually came away from the football side. So especially around finances, that's always been something that I've maybe had a different viewpoint on, because I was equally happy or equally sad no matter how much money I had in my bank account. And playing in the Premier League, you know, you get those opportunities to have nice houses and have nice cars. But I suppose I made that decision a long time ago that the money and the finances actually has no impact on my fulfillment and how content I feel in life. Now, I do just want to move on, Brendan, just in terms of one thing that is probably one of the most enjoyable parts of your life. It's something that whenever I know when I ask you this question and want you to talk us through, I know you'll absolutely share this so enthusiastically. But if I give the listeners a bit of a scenario of what happened whenever I went and spent the morning at your house, we went down. I'm just going to say loosely, we did some breathing exercises. And then we went and got showered and changed and cleaned off. But that wasn't the whole story. Can you maybe give us a little bit more of an insight of what you do on a daily basis and why you do it?
So on a daily basis, well, one of the rituals that I have, or one of the daily habits, the daily practices, is the Wim Hof method. So the Wim Hof method is three pillars. One of the pillars is breath control. The other pillar is cold therapy. And the third pillar is mindset. The mindset's required to actually embrace the cold. Why I do it, Paul, 5 or 6 years ago, after a personal trauma, I began meditating more, using, and challenged with it, I think, as everyone is, but found that apps like Headspace, I started off using Headspace, they were a great aid. Then I moved on to Calm, again, 10-minute guided meditations, wonderful. And it was my wife, actually, somebody had sent me a podcast. Said, listen to this guy, and it was Wim Hof being interviewed. Now, Wim Hof, for those who don't know, he's a Dutch guy, an amazing guy. We talk about purpose and vision. Again, I would invite anyone to Google Wim Hof and just hear the guy talk. He's so inspired about his own purpose to make the world happy, healthy, and strong. And the happiness comes from actually reducing inflammation through the method, which helps release serotonin, which makes us feel good. The healthy aspect of the happy, healthy, strong comes from actually a balancing of our immune system, again, through the breath control and the cold therapy. And the strength then comes from the mindset, that ability to get comfortable with being uncomfortable by getting yourself into ice. So the minute you stand into ice, or even I encourage people to start off with a kind of 30-second cold shower. So at the end of a hot shower, put it to cold, and your body initially engages your sympathetic nervous system and wants to flee. So it engages your fight, flight, or freeze, but it's the flight aspect of your sympathetic nervous system, and you will want to stand out. What you've got to do then, actually, using the breath, which is not the kind of the Wim Hof method breathing, but it's more vagus type breathing, just slow inhales, slow exhales, focus on the breath, and all of a sudden you start to calm down. And this method, I mean, we could spend another podcast on it. I mean, what the method does and why it has so much relevance. I found that if I got to kind of, if there was 10 levels in meditation, and I was at level 3. The Wim Hof method has taken me to level 6, level 7 in terms of, you know, experiencing a feeling. I practice it every day at 5:30 this morning. I was guided by some of my friends in Europe. And it's like a reboot, a reset every day. And then the cold, when you engage the cold, releases more epinephrine, as I say, which reduces inflammation and helps release serotonin. And it's a cardiovascular workout. You know, it has so many benefits. It's vasodilation and, you know, vasoconstriction, vasodilation. So 100,000 kilometers of veins and arteries running around the body, and which is enough to go around the world 2.5 times. And getting into the cold and warming back up again gives your cardiovascular system a workout. So given my father had a number of heart attacks, he's still living, thankfully, a very successful bypass about 20 years ago. My grandparents passed away with heart disease. There was so many benefits to the method. I listened to the podcast, I mentioned it to my wife, and very fortuitously, we ended up in a retreat in County Clare about 18 months ago. I was so inspired by the impact of the method that I then embarked on becoming a Wim Hof instructor. So, yes, it's hugely impactful, Paul.
And I think, Brendan, just listening to just the delivery of the way you've talked about it there and how much benefit you've got from it, you know, because it was something that I probably didn't do as much of the breathing, the meditative side of it as I was growing up and going through my footballing days, but definitely did the ice baths, you know, virtually on a daily basis. So getting in the ice baths at the start was horrible, you know. As you say, you know, the ice is merciless, you know, it's never going to be enjoyable, but you do get used to it. But then whenever I've started doing the breathing as well, and again, as a result of reconnecting with you and just understanding why both sides of it are so beneficial. But I still keep going back to every time I mention it to, you know, friends or family, the last thing they would ever want to do is get into a nice bath or go into the sea at 7 o'clock in the morning as the sun rises, even though it's one of the most enjoyable things I do now.
This is why you should do it. I mean, there's so much research that suggests you can prolong your life by putting your body under kind of hermetic stress, this kind of managed stress, and actually getting into an ice bath. We all suffer from the chatter in our heads. The minute you get into an ice bath, you cannot do anything other than focus on the breath. So it completely resets the mind. And then, as I say, there's so many other physiological benefits that, again, the research, there's now 7 different scientific research papers underpinning Wim's method, the 3 pillars of the method. So again, I would encourage people, invite people to explore it. His book's wonderful, actually, the Wim Hof Method. It's a wonderful insight into the guy, what makes him tick. As I say, vision and purpose come out really strong. Initially, when he brought this to the world, I mean, people just thought he's crazy. And when you Google the guy, you'll see why they think he's crazy. I met him actually it was March last year, and a wonderful individual. I mean, he's 60, 61 now, and so much energy. It's just infectious. So yeah, the method, Paul, and I encourage, you know, what's this got to do with scaling up? The scaling up a business is challenging. Any help you can get, and it's so easy to actually take the time to consciously breathe. Well, sorry, when I say so easy, you can do this anywhere. There's no equipment required. And when you understand the benefits that it's going to bring, especially when you go back to the earlier point about the 2015 scale-up report citing lack of ambition of the founder being one of the most significant impediments to companies achieving scale. If SME leaders can lean on something that's going to help them reset their mind, reset their thought patterns, and condition them to think positively, then that's got to be a good thing from a business perspective, let alone then all of the physiological benefits which the method brings. And I think from a leadership perspective, so critically important that actually as leaders, we do the inner work first. So it's self-leadership. Lead self first before you lead others, before you lead a team. You know, the one responsibility we have as leaders actually is to bring positive energy to the team. If we do nothing else, CEO, Chief Energy Officer, bring that positive energy to the team. And and ensure that actually you're doing the work behind that to make sure that you present yourself positively to them.
Brendan, I absolutely love that. I especially love the chief energy officer. I hadn't heard that before, so I'm definitely going to remember that one. Listen, I just have my last question for you. You know, we touched at the start about what is the definition of success, and you've talked about your career and all of the different highs and low points. And of course, every successful career is going to have the challenges and roadblocks along the way. Now in 2021, you said you're 46, you know, as a guy who's kind of come out of a really successful career, now starting another business. But what would you say is your definition of success going forward in your life?
So yeah, in my 20s, it was very different from my 30s. Now into my 40s, closer to 50 than I am to 40. It's about giving back. It's about actually taking the experiences that I have and sharing with those who want to take from that experience. I made so many mistakes that certainly I can help leaders of SMEs shortcut their aspirations to scale. You know, I've soon to be three teenagers. Owen's birthday is in July. So, you know, three teenagers in the house. You know, success is about being a good dad. It's about being a good husband. It's about being a good son. It's about being a good friend. You know, it's about giving back. Yeah, that if I can do that, Paul, I think I'll be doing quite well.
I think you're doing very well, Brendan. Brendan McGuigan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that really, really fascinating conversation and so inspiring listening to Brendan talk about his career. Please, please do again join us for the next episode of The Psychology of Success. Well, listening to Brendan there, that is just such a different insight and perspective from the world of business that I really have no knowledge of. So for him to share that understanding, that expertise, to take a company from 3 million to over 100 million was just fascinating. And for all of the other things he's doing in his life in terms of helping now SMEs grow and try and help them scale. But as well, as soon as he started talking about Wim Hof and the breathing and the ice water, you could really hear him light up and talk about the passion and enthusiasm he has and the benefits he gets for his own life. So I just really, really love that conversation with Brendan McGuigan. I hope you did too, and I hope you'll join us for another episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you to Moment Digital, who have produced today's live show, and that's Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor for all of the episodes that go up on iTunes and Spotify. Dave Webster has been our researcher, and Emily Drake does all of our social media marketing so we can get out every single episode of The Psychology of Success.